everybody, and welcome back to Fueling Forward Friday. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former elite runner. Today's episode, I will be answering questions you all have submitted to me beforehand. And if you would like to submit any questions in the future, you can do so at my website, www.fuelingforward.com, under the podcast tab, or you can send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I hope everyone is having a great week. Happy Friday. Thank you so much for bearing with me with last week's audio issues on the Grayson Murphy episode. When it first got uploaded, it sounded horrible. So I really appreciate everyone who tried to listen and let me know that it did that. And now it should be very listenable. I am the editor of the podcast, so I am not super tech savvy. So I was definitely panicking a little bit when that happened, but I was able to figure it out. You know, something that I really learned in owning my business and doing all these things is like, I would never have considered myself somebody who would own a business or start a podcast or edit a podcast or write a newsletter. And it's been really fun just to challenge myself to try new things, to try on different hats, learn new skills. It's been really, really enjoyable. So I appreciate everyone who has been with me on this journey, and thank you for bearing with me. It is just me. I am the host, the editor, the everything for the podcast. So thank you guys for sticking with it. And thank you to everyone who has been submitting questions for the Q&As. I've been getting so many great questions, and I'm doing my best to get through them as fast as I can. There's just so many great ones, and every question is just like slightly different, so I love reading through all of them. So thank you, and definitely keep submitting your questions. Feel free to submit more than one, too. If you have multiple questions, make multiple submissions. That's what this is for. I want to be a reliable source of information for all of you. I hope everyone is enjoying listening to the answers. Let's see what else. Last week was the official start of my New York Marathon build. So I have not run a double digit long run since I retired from elite running last summer. So the last two weekends, Nick and I have done 10 miles on Sunday, which has definitely felt long compared to what I've been running. But that's the point of the build, right? Like, you just build up, you get used to 10 miles, then you bump it up a little more and you keep getting used to it. So it's been fun just to kind of have more structure with my training. On Tuesdays, I've been volunteer coaching at a high school out here. So I just do a workout with the girls. So getting myself in high school 5K shape, which will also help me for the marathon. So it's kind of a fun way to just be really flexible with my training. Getting to the gym more often for strength training, that's a huge thing for me personally for injury prevention and just feeling better when I'm running. I find that I can get back into running faster if I kind of stay on top of my lifting and keep those muscles strong that I need to run efficiently. So that's been really fun. And my hydration vest came in the mail yesterday. So I had posted on Instagram a few weeks ago asking for recommendations for like a hydration vest or like hydration pack, and the one that I got is the Salomon Advanced Skin 4. And so I just washed it and I'm going to use it for my long run. So I'll keep you guys posted on how it goes. But just with it being hot and wanting to get better at hydrating during runs, making sure I have fluids with me, that's going to be really helpful. For the marathon, especially, practicing drinking fluids while I'm running is something that I don't do often. So that's a skill I want to make sure I have really nailed down before race day. And then being able to carry all my fuel, my gels. I had mentioned Nick was going to be my pack mule, but just decided I want to carry it myself. I want to have access to it whenever I want it. So I'm going to have one and he's going to have one. So we'll have double the fuel, double the hydration, double the fun, which will be great. So yeah, really looking forward to continuing this build. I hope everyone else who's doing a fall marathon is enjoying the start of their build. If you're doing something like Chicago, I know we're a little closer to your race day, so I hope all is going well. Definitely feel free to write in with your fall marathon questions if you have any questions about your fall marathon fueling. All right, let's go ahead and dive into today's questions. The first question comes from Grace, and Grace says, I'm a volunteer coach for a women's college cross-country team. The ladies are starting to do double threshold workouts. A double threshold day tends to include a morning cross-training threshold session on the ARC trainer, 60 minutes including warm-up and cool-down, and an afternoon threshold session on the track, about 2 hours including warm-up and cool-down. What should fueling and refueling look like surrounding these workouts? Also, do you think that taking in carbohydrates and or electrolytes during either or both sessions would be beneficial? Yeah, super great question. I definitely would say you have to think about the total volume on the day when you're thinking about a double session. So, you know, for example, even if your double was shorter cross training, you're still putting an hour of strain on your body in the morning. And, you know, I've talked about before how glycogen stores, we can start digging into those as early as an hour into training. And especially with that being first thing in the morning, there's a couple of suggestions that I would have for your athletes. The first one is definitely make sure to fuel before that first session. I know it can be tempting sometimes to just like roll out of bed and show up. And especially if it's cross training, I think a lot of athletes forget how much cross training actually takes out of you. And it's still something that requires fuel. So making sure that you are fueling before the morning cross training session is definitely important. Depending on when you're actually doing the cross training session, you know, if it's an early morning thing and you don't have a lot of time, something small like an English muffin with butter and jam or toast or something on your way out the door is also fine. A benefit to cross training is that you can usually get away with eating a little more before you start cross training. It's not as much of a GI issue concern when you're cross training compared to when you're running. So definitely making sure to fuel before your cross training session. I would recommend bringing some electrolytes with carbs with you to have during that cross training session, mostly to help with hydration, but also to give you a little bit of fuel during that session. So a bottle of Scratch or Tailwind or Gatorade, whatever you like, something with some carbs and electrolytes would be great. The key then is the recovery and replenishment of your energy stores between sessions. So after that first session, being really intentional about trying to eat something within an hour, really focusing on those carbs. Of course, we want to make sure that we're also getting protein, but having enough carbs to refill those energy stores is going to be super important. So if you're able to access, you know, the dining hall or get breakfast within an hour of finishing that first cross-training session, that's great. If not, if you have class or if you have something else right afterwards, bringing something with you like a smoothie, a recovery drink, plus a banana or a bar with carbs, you know, making sure you're getting both the carbs and the protein is really critical. After that, you know, eating about every 2 to 3 hours throughout the day leading up to your evening session. So thinking about how this session you said is 2 hours, including warm up and cool down. I have mentioned before that I really recommend trying to have fuel during runs that are 75 minutes or more. The amount of fuel that you need definitely depends on the intensity of the workout. So it sounds like with a double threshold workout, that's going to be a more intense 2 hours in general. But I also know it can be hard to take in fuel like during the threshold itself, especially if you're not training for a marathon where you have to practice taking in fuel at that effort. So what I would recommend doing is, you know, making sure you're having your fuel about an hour, 1 to 2 hours before practice. You know, your pre-run snack that's high in carbs, something like a Clif Bar. You know, I love to do tortillas with peanut butter, banana slices, and honey and kind of roll it up. That one always works really well for me. And then bringing some fuel with you, I would say having like a gel, for example, a packet of fruit snacks, something pretty simple, in between the warm-up and the workout. So that would probably end up being like at, you know, 30 minutes or so into your training. You know, having something while you're changing your shoes, if you guys change from trainers into a different shoe for the workout, having your fuel while you do that, that's always what I would do, is I would have my fuel in between the warm-up and the workout while I was changing my shoes. So that's an easy way to add some fuel in. Again, I would definitely make sure you're bringing hydration with you to practice, and including electrolytes, but I would encourage you to bring electrolytes that also have carbs for these kinds of workouts. So again, Scratch, Tailwind, Gatorade, whatever you like. And just kind of sipping on that if you're doing like you know, repeats and you have a 90 second rest between intervals, like taking a few sips of your electrolyte drink then, you know, if it's a solid chunk of a threshold where you're not really stopping, like that's okay. You don't necessarily need to focus on fueling during that, especially for collegiate where you're training for a 6K, you're not going to be fueling during the 6K race. So you don't necessarily need to practice fueling during that 6K effort. But definitely making sure that you have something between the warm up and the workout, depending on how long your cool down is. This is something I wish that I would have done more often, was having something between the workout and the cool down, especially if you're trying to get in a lot of mileage and you're going to do like a 3 or 4 mile cool down. There is nothing more brutal than trying to do a 3 or 4 mile cool down after a big workout when you're exhausted. That just drags on. So adding a little extra fuel will just help you feel better on that cool down and then probably feel more comfortably hungry going into your meal after training. So again, depending on what you're doing, if you are finishing up your double threshold day and you can go straight to eat dinner, that's definitely what I would recommend doing. If you're doing like strength training after the workout, then making sure you bring something to have in between, like a chocolate milk or a bar, so you get something closer to the workout itself. But definitely making sure you're intentional about your fueling throughout the day, before and after those training sessions, bringing electrolytes with carbs to have during the training sessions, and then also potentially having something like a gel or fruit snacks or an applesauce pouch between the warm-up and the workout for the second workout of the day. And remember with these, the faster that you can recover, the better you're going to be able to stack your training days and gain more from your training. If a double threshold day knocks you out for 3 or 4 days, it's going to be a lot harder to improve and see that consistency, because it's going to be harder for you to show up and have a good workout the next time you have a workout day. So it's not always just about getting through the workout itself. You probably can get through that kind of a day, although it might be a little challenging without proper fueling, but that doesn't mean that you should, and that doesn't mean that that's going to actually set you up for success later in the week. Remember, fueling is not just about that specific day. It's about how it's going to impact you throughout the week, throughout the training block, heading into the races themselves. Really important that that recovery piece is there. The less depleted you get after training, the faster you can recover. So even from a recovery standpoint, just thinking about it that way, it's going to be really helpful to be more intentional with fueling on those days. Great question, Grace. Thanks so much for asking that. Okay, this next question says, "Hi, Maddie. I'm a senior high school runner with a big appetite. I find myself comparing how much I'm eating to friends and family and feel bad about eating more than them, especially since I'm much shorter, only 4'10". Do you have any tips on how to deal with food comparison? Thank you so much." Yeah, super great question. I know food comparison can be really tricky to navigate. So the first thing that I would say is remembering that your goals and your needs are going to be different than your friends and family. So especially if you have friends who are not runners or family members who are not runners, you're asking very different things of your body. So of course your fueling should look different than their fueling. You are training, you're doing all these other things that require a lot more energy, a lot more carbs. So of course that means that your plates are probably going to be bigger. You're probably going to have bigger portions of carbs. That's probably a good thing. If you're looking at your plate and you're like, wow, this is so much more food than what the people around me are eating, instead of thinking about that as a bad thing, maybe thinking about that as, oh, I'm probably doing something right then. If these people aren't training the way that I'm training, then of course my plate needs to look bigger and look different. If the people around you are teammates and they are training the way that you're training, that can also be hard for comparison. So just remembering that someone else's fueling choices have nothing to do with your own. They do not determine what your fueling needs are and how much your body actually needs. And I've run into this a lot with runners who've lost their periods and they're trying to get their periods back. And they say, oh, it's just not fair. I have teammates who don't eat nearly as much as I do and they have a regular period. They don't have any issues. Unfortunately, it's going to take what it's going to take. And that can be hard to accept if it's more than what somebody else is doing. We also don't know if that other person is making good choices for themselves. There's a good chance that if their plate is really small, they're not getting enough carbs, they might not be making smart choices for supporting their training. And it may be something that shows up later. You know, I've talked about this before where sometimes it can be hard because you'll see a teammate or another runner that you know is not taking care of themselves and they're beating you in races. That can be really difficult and really confusing. But the problem is that's not sustainable and that success doesn't last. And it's really hard to see then that athlete enter an injury cycle and get really frustrated. And just, you know, seeing one glimpse of a runner that's running really well doesn't mean that they're doing things the right way or the healthy way. And it also doesn't mean that what they're doing is right for you. Like I said earlier, everyone's fueling needs are different, and it's going to take what it's going to take to get you to that point of proper fueling to support your training, your goals, and your recovery. So that comparison can be so hard, but something that I try to remind athletes and even remind myself sometimes is just keeping your eyes on your own plate. It really doesn't matter what other people around you are doing because it doesn't affect what your body's needs are and what your goals are. I also want to point out that if you have somebody around you who is comparing their plate to yours, it's not really about you, right? It's more so about them and their insecurities that they're projecting onto you. And it's not about you. It's not because you made the wrong choice. It's more so because this person is struggling with their own relationship with food and their own choices. You know, if we reflect on ourselves, if there is a time where we're struggling with our relationship with food or we're struggling with body image, you know, you'd probably think back and be like, oh yeah, of course, I was looking at everyone else's plate. I was looking at everyone else's body. I was really, you know, judging them or comparing, but it wasn't actually about them. It was about you and your insecurities. And that's how it is if somebody else were to do that to you, right? It's not about you. And someone else making a comment about your plate, it doesn't mean that you made the wrong choice. You know, don't let them make you second guess your choices. Trust yourself, trust your body, and remember that only you know what you need. And I will say too, even though this person mentioned that they're shorter, 4'10", so probably a smaller build, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your needs are going to be lower than your friends, especially if they're not running the way that you are. If you're 4'10", you're probably still growing, which means that when you're in a period of growth, your energy needs are even higher. So, you know, just because you're a smaller or shorter person doesn't necessarily mean that you need less than what your friends and family are eating. Again, especially if they're not super active. I think one of the most helpful things for me when I'm thinking about comparing what I'm eating to other people is trying to focus on when I feel the best. And I feel the best when I listen to my body, when I eat meals that are balanced, that have carbs, color, and protein, when I know that I've eaten enough at a meal, when I've had snacks in between meals so I'm not getting super hungry throughout the day. You know, just remembering that you are going to feel your best if you listen to your body and eat when it's right for you and eat what's right for you. Thinking about outside factors for other people coming to meals, maybe they had a huge snack right before this meal and they're not feeling very hungry. You know, maybe they're coming off of an illness and they're not feeling like eating food. There could be so many different factors behind someone else's food choices too that you just might not know or might not notice. And so you can't really look at somebody's plate once or twice or even daily and really know why they're making that choice. And again, it also doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect what you actually need or what you should be doing. So I know that can be easier said than done, but doing the best that you can to focus on yourself, knowing what makes your body feel good and avoiding what doesn't make your body feel good. So for me, that's eating small meals or skipping snacks. I don't feel good when I do that. So even if my plate looks more like people's around me, I don't feel like the best version of myself if I do that. So trusting yourself, trusting your body, and just really doing your best to keep your eyes on your own plate and reminding yourself that someone else's needs don't determine my own. Okay, this next question says, hey Maddie, do you have any advice on how to take gels? I've never eaten anything while running before and I'm scared that my stomach won't be able to tolerate gels at first. I'm running collegiately right now, but one day I would love to get into marathon training where it's inevitable to avoid taking gels. Yeah, great question. So I would say gels can be an acquired taste and an acquired tool. It's definitely something that took me some time to get used to. But The reason that they're so popular is because they're easy to take while you're running, and they're formulated to support your fueling needs while you're running. So my suggestion is to start by trying a bunch of different gels. There are so many gels on the market. I mean, I just learned about three new ones yesterday. You know, there's gels that are thick, there's gels that are thin, there's gels that are flavored, there's gels that are unflavored, gels with caffeine, gels without caffeine. There's so many different options out there. And I think a lot of us, when we're introduced to gels, we think about something like goo, where it's just this really thick, really sweet, really kind of fake tasting gel. Some people love goo, and that is great. There's a reason why it's one of the most popular gels that's been around for a really long time. But a lot of people find that it's not really a beginner-friendly gel. It's just hard to take in. It's sticky, it's sweet, it's really thick. It's definitely not something that goes down smoothly while you're running. So I think playing around with some different options, and there are so many different places where you can buy different types of gels. Like, you can go to your local running store and just kind of peruse the shelves and see what they have there. You can go to an online sports nutrition retail store like The Feed or Fuel Goods. They have lots of different combinations of gels that you can look at, buy single serving gels or sample packs and try different things. So a couple things that I would recommend looking at when you're trying to decide what gel might be right for you. The first would be consistency. So if you're somebody who needs like a thin gel, you would prefer something that's a little bit thinner or more liquidy. Starting there, looking for gels that are a little thinner and kind of fit that profile. So a couple gels that I have personally liked and tried, Goo Liquid. So the same brand Goo, they make a liquid version that's like truly just pure liquid. I love that one. They have a lemonade flavor. That's my go-to. That's probably my preference for runs. That's as thin as it gets. That's like a water consistency. After that, you have things like Precision, which is an unflavored one. You have SIS or Science and Sport gels. That's probably my other favorite one right now. I really like the salted strawberry. Those flavors are hit or miss for me. Like, the cherry one tastes really medicinal, but I like the raspberry or the strawberry one. So like, trying different flavors too, you might find you like different flavor profiles. Those are also really nice thin gels. You know, a little bit thicker would be something like a honey stinger gel. That's going to be more like, you know, honey consistency. There's also gels that are more real food based. So if you really don't like that kind of artificial taste, Spring Energy gel is a good one. I know they had kind of that little issue with carb content being a little bit lower, but it is something that's a good like introductory option. Huma gel is another one that's made with chia seeds, so that people tend to like that one. I would say it kind of tastes like jam. You can get different flavors with that too. So just, again, like looking around, seeing what's available. Morton is a really popular one. That one has more of like a jello consistency. So it's not really liquidy and it's not really thick. I don't really know how to explain it. Like, jello is probably the best way to explain it. And it doesn't have a specific flavor. So it's sort of just like sweet. So those are some things to think about when you're looking at gels. Caffeine is another one to think about. So some gels have a really low amount, like 20 milligrams. Some get up to 100 or more milligrams. If you're new to gels, I would recommend starting with the uncaffeinated versions and just getting used to taking in fuel during your run. If you do want to try caffeinated, start with a lower dose and see how that impacts your body. Most runners that I've worked with who get up to the 100 milligram of caffeine gels start to notice they feel more GI issues, so that's something to keep in mind too. And then there are gels that have really high carb content. So SIS has a beta fuel gel that has double the amount of carbs as a typical gel. I also don't recommend starting with those for beginners, for many reasons. But really what it comes down to with practicing with gels and starting with gels, what we're trying to do is increase the amount of glucose transporters in your GI tract. So if you're not fueling during runs, the amount of glucose transporters that you have in your GI tract, which is what will absorb that fuel that you're taking in, is going to be a lot lower. So starting small is key to avoid oversaturating your gut and getting something called dumping syndrome, where water rushes into the gut to try to balance out the concentration of carbs that's in there if we're getting too much at once. And that's usually what causes GI issues like cramping, bloating, bathroom stops, all of that during runs. So starting small, you can train your gut to build more glucose transporters. So just like you would train your muscles to build up to get stronger and tolerate more mileage, you can train your gut to get stronger and tolerate more carbs. And that's why I have people start practicing for race day fueling well in advance of the race. Like, I recommend starting pretty much day one of your marathon build, practicing with that fuel. Maybe not day one if your run's not very long, but your first long run of the marathon build. So I spent my last 2 weeks trying out some different gels to see what I like, so I can kind of decide what tastes the best to me. A couple other factors when it comes to gels, cost is definitely one. So some of the gels out there are super expensive. They can be up to like $450 per gel, which I know when you're doing your longer runs and you're fueling on your runs often throughout the week, that's probably not going to be super sustainable for a lot of people. So practicing with some different types of gels, and maybe if you like a lower cost gel, using that for the majority of your training. Just make sure that if you're planning to use the more expensive gel for race day, you get at least 2 long runs where you're focusing on that gel to make sure that it works well for you. The other thing to think about is if you'll have access to fluids during your run. So you definitely want to make sure that you're taking in fluids if you're taking in fuel during your run. Again, your gut doesn't really tolerate carbs without fluid. We need to make sure that we have water on board, ideally with electrolytes, to really optimize how our body's going to absorb that fuel. We have those glucose transporters that I mentioned. A lot of them are sodium glucose transporters. So making sure that we have some electrolytes with sodium or gels that have sodium, and then having some fluids can help us absorb them better. Some gels are what are called isotonic gels. So meaning they kind of match the concentration within our GI tract and can be absorbed without fluids. Gels that are not isotonic and they're more concentrated, that's what tends to cause those GI issues to happen, because they're more concentrated than what our gut likes. So isotonic gels, Morton is one, SIS is one, Goo Liquid is one. All those that I mentioned are great because you can take them anywhere. If you're somebody who stops on runs at water fountains, you know, making sure that you, if you have a gel that's not isotonic, that you plan your fuel around your water fountain. So that's where the isotonic gels can be great for long runs, because you can take them anytime. The ultimate goal for most people is to work up to around 60 grams of carbs per hour. So for a marathon runner, that would be kind of the minimum goal for race day. And it depends on the person. Some people are going to be a little closer to like 40 to 50 grams of carbs per hour. Some of the more elite runners that I work with get up to 80 to 90 grams of carbs per hour, or even higher. So it really just depends on you and your goals and kind of how you're approaching your training. But definitely starting with at least 20 grams of carbs per hour. So most gels are around 20 grams of carbs per gel. So it's about a gel per hour. And then kind of working your way up to having 2 to 3 gels per hour. So you're getting closer to that 60 grams of carbs. There are other fuel options for sure. So you can do energy chews. You can have hydration mix that has carbs in it. For me personally, it's not realistic to be trying to chew something when I'm running. That's just not going to happen. I'm not going to get in enough fuel to meet those needs. You know, for most energy chews, you'd have to eat 5 to 7 per hour of your run. So that's a gel every like, or a chew every like 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. And that's just not going to happen for me. So thinking about logistics, I think it's also a little stickier to try to eat chews when you're running. And then the drink mixes can be great, but you have to finish them. So if you're somebody who tends to take a couple sips of your water and then you finish your run and you still have half your bottle left, you didn't get in all those carbs. So again, you know, if you're trying to take in at least 20 grams of carbs per hour, that would typically be a serving of electrolytes per hour. And most people aren't carrying enough fluids to hit that need. It can be a great way to supplement it though. So if you're somebody who's like, I can't take 3 gels per hour, then swap out a gel for a drink mix. That's a great option. You know, and again, practicing drinking liquids while you're running is really important for marathons, just so that your body knows how to handle that, how to tolerate it. But generally with gels, I know they can be really intimidating. There are so many options out there that really aren't that bad. You can also just try out a gel without running. Like just open a gel, waste it, like put it in a spoon, just taste it and see what it tastes like, get the texture. If you're somebody who tends to be a little more reactive to those kinds of things, just like taste it in a neutral environment first so you kind of know what to expect when you are out on your run. But just, you know, start small, start at halfway, work your way up. That's kind of the best advice that I have. And just again, know that what works for somebody that you run with might not work for you. So it's really important that you develop your own personal during run fueling plan, just because everybody is going to be so different. Okay, the last question for today says, I have dealt with low ferritin for years, around 18 to 21. And I recently started taking iron consistently. My doctor recommended to take it every other day to help with better absorption. After taking it consistently for 3 months, I had it rechecked and it increased from 20 to 23. My doctor told me to keep the course and continue taking. I was hopeful it would increase faster than this. Is this typical? Should I be taking it every day? What is the level that an infusion is needed? Yeah, super great question. So I think it's good to kind of revisit some of these blood work ones, especially if you're somebody who's heading into a fall cross-country season or fall marathon block. It's always good to check your iron. So again, remember that this is not medical advice. Definitely make sure you're working with your healthcare practitioners on this. But a couple of things I would say is that, first of all, ferritin by itself is not always the best way to track iron. It's one lab, but I have a couple different labs I like to look at to better understand how iron is actually moving, how it's being absorbed. Is it actually going into your cells? So a couple other labs you would want to check. A CBC panel would give you hemoglobin and hematocrit. So the way you can think about hemoglobin and ferritin is like your money in your wallet that you're going to spend up first and kind of finish that up before you dig into the money in your bank, which is your hemoglobin. So early stage iron deficiencies, sometimes ferritin can be low and everything else looks normal. And if that's the case, then it sounds like we're having more of a problem with being able to stay on top of iron needs, but we actually have enough on board. If we see low hemoglobin and low ferritin, that tells me there's probably more going on in terms of absorption or overall iron intake. So those are things we want to explore more. We can also look in the CBC panel about the size of your red blood cells. So sometimes if your red blood cells are enlarged, that can indicate we have a B12 or a folate deficiency, which that can be also related to certain types of anemia, where we have anemia related to B12 or folate deficiency. Total iron, iron binding capacity, and iron saturation are also something I have athletes look at. That's going to tell us more about how much iron is actually in the serum of your blood. So sometimes I'll see a serum iron that's really high, but an iron saturation or a ferritin that's low. And that tells me iron is not moving from blood into the cells like it should be. So we're going to see low iron labs, despite the fact that we have plenty of access to iron. So in all of those situations, there are different approaches that I would take with the athlete. You know, if we genuinely have low iron, and we've been consistently taking iron, I would probably dig into GI issues, potential food allergies or intolerances. Is there something that's really preventing this runner from absorbing the iron? Is there something that we're missing? Is there potentially a GI bleed that's affecting blood loss? You know, that's definitely something you would want to look into a bit more. So something I'll do with those athletes is a GI map test, which is just a stool test that looks at digestive capacity, you know, if there's any type of immune reaction happening in the gut, if there's any type of blood present in the stool, you know, those are things we would dig into more and then potentially refer out to a GI doctor if there's something more alarming. I've had a couple athletes recently come back with immune reactions to gluten, which does not happen as often as you would think. So I know a lot of athletes are like, oh, my iron's low, I'm going to cut out gluten. I don't recommend doing that because low carb intake can also affect iron. But if you do have something like an immune reaction to gluten, removing that from your diet will help you better absorb nutrients like iron. Low stomach acid can also contribute to iron issues, and especially if B12 is part of the picture, we need stomach acid to digest and absorb iron and B12. So if we don't have enough stomach acid, we might see more absorption issues as well. So if that's the case for somebody, you know, there's different therapeutic things we would do to target that. If the person has, like I said earlier, high serum iron and the iron is not moving into cells like it should be, then we would look more at the nutrients that support iron movement. So typically that would be things like copper and zinc and vitamin A. How are we doing with those things? And again, I don't want to tell people to take supplements. That's not really what I do. But one thing I will say that I've seen help with athletes is cod liver oil. The vitamin A is in the retinol form. So you've probably heard of retinol from skincare. But retinol form of vitamin A in the diet really helps support a transport protein called ceruloplasmin that can help improve iron movement. So I've had an athlete whose ferritin has gone up 30 points in 3 weeks by adding in more vitamin A from cod liver oil. So that's a great one. Again, definitely talk with your doctor. There can be interactions with that. If you're pregnant, you do not want to be taking high doses of vitamin A, so that wouldn't be the right thing for you. But depending on the athlete, that may be something that we try out. And then lastly, I would obviously want to take a look at overall fueling. So a lot of times if I have an athlete who's dealing with chronic low ferritin despite supplementation, that often means we're missing something with our fueling. We have to make sure we have the building blocks in place from our diet to support the formation of new and healthy red blood cells. So it doesn't matter how much iron we're taking if we're not doing what we need to do to support overall intake. Those iron supplements typically don't work. So we want to make sure we're eating enough carbs. Those are really big ones for iron. Lastly, if you've done all those things, nothing else is making sense, there is a connection between iron and thyroid. So potentially having your doctor run a thyroid panel to look for any signs of hypothyroid that can cause chronically low ferritin as well. I've had a few athletes miss that. And I personally, I haven't shared too much of this journey, and maybe I will, but I actually was diagnosed with Hashimoto's hypothyroid a couple of years ago. And I was dealing with chronically low ferritin despite doing all of these things. We couldn't figure it out. And so once I was working with a doctor on that, I was able to improve ferritin and I didn't have any issues after that. So sometimes it can be a symptom of something else that may be going on, maybe an underlying condition that's contributing to chronically low iron. For iron infusions, you typically have to have pretty low levels, and that's going to vary from clinic to clinic. But, you know, a ferritin of 20 doesn't typically qualify people for an infusion. You also would have to look at hemoglobin, total iron, iron saturation, all those other labs as well to determine if you would be a good candidate for an infusion. But I would say the issue I have with infusions is they're kind of a band-aid, quick fix for whatever might be going on. So maybe that's appropriate if you have a season coming up or a race coming up and you don't have enough time to do the digging to figure out what's happening and you need to get that extra iron in if your labs are dangerously low. Certainly something to think about, but I would say otherwise, the infusions only last a certain amount of time, and it's important to try to understand more about that whole picture. So more testing is kind of the first thing I would say. Potentially trying a different form of a supplement. If you've been taking the same form of iron, some people just respond better to other forms. So trying a different form out. It could also be when you're taking your iron and what you're taking it with. So if you're taking iron with things that interfere with absorption, like coffee, tea, dairy, those are things that are going to reduce how much iron you're actually absorbing. So it's best to take iron on a relatively empty stomach at least 1 hour after and 1 hour before eating. So for a lot of runners I work with, the time that tends to be the best for them is either if they run in the morning, an hour after their post-run breakfast, or sometime in the evening before they go to bed, usually after they have their bedtime snack. That tends to be a good time for them. So try different timing of your supplement, potentially try a different form. Really be mindful of your overall intake. And if none of that's working, exploring more options with testing for things like GI issues, thyroid, or allergies. All right, thank you so much. That's all for today. Thank you to everyone who submitted their questions. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. If you'd like to submit a question for the next Q&A episode, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can email me at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.